At a great educational institution, the air is electric with ideas and with questions. And it is from that environment that students derive an intellectual stimulation that should last them the rest of their lives. It is, I submit, the intense, strenuous, and constant intellectual activity of the place. I trust the marketplace of ideas more than I do a president of the United States or a president of a university to decide what views are acceptable and what are not.
That's Jeffrey Stone, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jeffrey Stone on the fight for free speech on campus. The political landscape is increasingly intolerant of opposing views. Campuses are sometimes a battleground. Author Charles Murray was shouted down and prevented from speaking at Middlebury College. Condoleezza Rice declined to speak at Rutgers because of student protests. Ex-Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos' talk at UC Berkeley was called off when a minority became violent. Professors such as Stephen Salida and Norman Finkelstein have lost jobs because of what they said. The American Civil Liberties Union states unequivocally, "How much we value the right of free speech is put to its severest test when the speaker is someone we disagree with most. Speech that deeply offends our morality or is hostile to our way of life warrants the same constitutional protection as other speech, because the right of free speech is indivisible. When one of us is denied this right, all of us are denied." Our guest today is Jeffrey Stone. He's a noted First Amendment and constitutional law scholar and distinguished professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's the award-winning author of many books, including Top Secret and Speaking Out. He spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And now, Jeffrey Stone.
So whenever I speak to students generally, I can't help but recall an incident involving Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. At the time of this incident, Holmes was a very old man, nearing 90 years of age, in the autumn of his very long and very distinguished career as a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States. On this particular occasion, Holmes was on a train headed north from Washington, and he was deeply engrossed in reading a legal brief when the conductor knocked on the door to his compartment. Recognizing Justice Holmes, the conductor respectfully asked for his ticket. Holmes looked in his coat pocket, no ticket. He looked in his vest pocket, no ticket. He reached into his trouser pocket, no ticket. Growing ever more frantic, Holmes began rummaging desperately through his briefcase, still no ticket. At this point, the conductor, trying to calm Holmes, said, "Never mind, Mr. Justice, it's really not a problem. When you find the ticket, just mail it into the company." To which Holmes exploded, "You dolt, I don't give a damn about your ticket. I just want to know where the hell I'm supposed to be going." So, as students, you must often feel a bit like Justice Holmes. You want to know where the hell you're supposed to be going. And my task is to offer at least some sense of direction this afternoon. So I'd like to begin by telling you a bit about my world. It is the world of the law, and more specifically, it is the world of constitutional law. Law is, of course, about stories. It is about real people involved in real disputes with real consequences. So I shall tell you a story. This story begins during World War I. As you may or may not know, World War I was not a particularly popular war with the American people, whose sympathies were sharply divided. Many Americans vigorously opposed the Wilson administration's decision to intervene in the brutal conflict that was then raging in Europe, arguing that our intervention was both unwise and immoral. Not surprisingly, such opposition did not sit well with the government. In 1917, Attorney General Thomas Gregory, attacking the loyalty of war opponents, declared, "May God have mercy on them, for they can expect none from an avenging government." Gregory wasn't kidding about the avenging government. In 1918, Congress enacted the Sedition Act, which made it a crime for any person to utter any disloyal, scurrilous, or abusive language intended to cause contempt or disrepute for the government of the United States, the Constitution, or the flag. True to the Attorney General's threat, federal authorities launched more than 2,000 prosecutions against individuals who wrote or spoke against the war or the draft. Now, one such prosecution involved five young Russian Jewish emigrants who were roughly the age of the students here at the time. In the summer of 1918, the United States sent a contingent of Marines to Vladivostok in Russia. Fearing that this was the first step of an American effort to crush the Russian Revolution, these five self-proclaimed socialists threw several thousand copies of each of two leaflets, one in English, the other in Yiddish, from several rooftops on the Lower East Side of New York City. The leaflets, which were boldly signed "The Rebels," were addressed to other Russian emigrants to the United States. After stating that the rebels hated German militarism, they warned those who worked in ammunition factories that they were producing bullets, bayonets, and cannon to murder not only the Germans, but also your dearest, your best, who were in Russia and who were fighting for their freedom. The rebels were immediately arrested by the military police. After a controversial trial, they were convicted of violating the Sedition Act of 1918. The trial judge, disgusted by their behavior and by their beliefs, sentenced the rebels to terms ranging up to 20 years in prison. The rebels appealed their convictions to the Supreme Court of the United States, claiming that their convictions violated the First Amendment, which guarantees that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. In Abrams versus the United States, the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, rejected this claim and upheld the convictions. For the majority of the court, this was an easy case, because the natural tendency of the defendant's speech was to generate opposition to the war, it was not within the freedom of speech protected by the Constitution. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, the same Justice Holmes who some years later was to lose his railway ticket, dissented. Holmes' dissenting opinion in Abrams is worth reading, for it remains one of the most eloquent statements ever written by a justice of the Supreme Court about the freedom of expression. Holmes wrote, quote, "Persecution for the expression of opinion seems to me perfectly logical. If you have no doubt of your premises and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally want to sweep away all opposition." But he added, "When men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, that the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market, and that truth is the only ground upon which our wishes can safely be carried out." Holmes therefore concluded that we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression, even of opinions we loathe and believe to be fraught with death, unless they so imminently threaten compelling government interests that an immediate check is necessary to save the nation. Now, in discussing the theme of my talk today, free speech on campus, it's important to acknowledge two rather different perspectives. First, for public universities, there is the First Amendment. Second, for all colleges and universities, public and private alike, there is the principle of academic freedom. Academic freedom is, of course, protected by the First Amendment, but the principle of academic freedom, which is endorsed and cherished by colleges and universities, wholly apart from the demands of the Constitution, is a separate and independent value that rests at the very heart of the American educational system. The First Amendment provides that government shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. This command is binding on the University of Oregon and the University of California because they are public institutions, but not on Stanford or the University of Chicago because they are private institutions. But what does the First Amendment mean? What does it mean to abridge the freedom of speech? One approach might be to take the First Amendment literally. Government shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. What this would mean, for example, is that the University of Oregon could never restrict anyone's speech, ever, period. Justice Holmes put this interpretation of the First Amendment to rest almost 100 years ago with this famous hypothetical of the false cry of fire in a crowded theater. Clearly, Holmes reasoned it would be crazy to permit the state not to be able to punish such speech. Thus, the First Amendment, he concluded, clearly can't be taken literally. But that presented a huge challenge. For if the First Amendment doesn't mean what it seems to say, then what does it mean? Over the past century, the Supreme Court has developed a rich and often quite complex jurisprudence to make sense of the First Amendment. In wildly oversimplified form, here are four basic ground rules. Rule number one. In general, the government cannot constitutionally punish or restrict speech because its message is offensive, hurtful, or causes harm, unless the speech causes a clear and present danger of grave harm. This is indeed the central meaning of the First Amendment. But it took the Supreme Court a long time to get to that conclusion. As we've already seen with the Abrams case, there was a time when the court held that speech could be punished if it merely had the tendency to cause harm. For example, under this view, criticism of a war might cause some draft-eligible men to refuse induction, or criticism of a politician might infuriate some of his supporters, leading to a fight. Although the court initially held that such speech could be punished, it eventually came to the realization that such a doctrine would lead, and indeed did lead, to the widespread suppression of free speech. It thus eventually came around to embracing what I've called rule number one. That brings me to rule number two. As an exception to rule number one, the Supreme Court has recognized that there are some specific categories of speech that have only low First Amendment value, and that therefore can be constitutionally restricted if they cause a more modest degree of harm. Examples of such low-value speech are false statements of fact, express threats, and obscenity. The court has held that these types of speech have only low First Amendment value because they do not further the core marketplace of ideas, values of the First Amendment, and because they do not restrict the communication of any particular point of view. Thus, if Tom tells a lie about Jane that seriously hurts her reputation, Jane can sue Tom for damages. And if Bill threatens to kill Steve if he doesn't give him $1,000, Bill can be punished for making a threat. These categories of low-value speech are narrowly defined and sharply limited, but they do exist. Rule number three deals with regulations of speech that do not turn on the content of the message being communicated. Such regulations are called content-neutral regulations. For example, a law prohibiting anyone to use a loudspeaker in a residential neighborhood after 9 o'clock at night, a law prohibiting billboards above a certain size, and a law prohibiting anyone to disrupt a speaker by making noise at the event are content-neutral laws. Because they apply neutrally to all speakers, regardless of the message being communicated, the Supreme Court sees them as less threatening to core First Amendment values. They are therefore constitutional as long as they are reasonable, a judgment that often requires a balancing of the competing interests at stake. Rule number four recognizes that the applications of the first three rules sometimes vary based on the circumstances and on the relationship of the speaker to the government. For example, the first three rules might apply differently in prisons, or in the military, or in courtrooms, than they apply in general public discourse. Similarly, they might apply differently to government employees than to citizens generally. For example, if the government hires Mary to be a national security analyst, she could be punished for leaking classified information that the New York Times could publish. Or if the university hires Fred to edit its alumni magazine, and he publishes articles that clearly and deeply alienate the alumni, he can be fired for not doing his job, which is, of course, to make the alumni love the place. So in very simple form, these are the four central rules of the First Amendment, and they apply in full force to public universities. In Rosenberger v. University of Virginia, for example, the Supreme Court held that the University of Virginia could not constitutionally fund all student publications except for religious publications, because that policy violated the university's constitutional obligation not to discriminate against particular points of view. And in Pappas v. University of Missouri, the Supreme Court held that the University of Missouri could not constitutionally discipline a student for distributing on campus a newspaper containing a political cartoon depicting policemen raping the Statue of Liberty and an article that repeatedly used the phrase. But I now must change direction, for this is not to be a discourse specifically about the First Amendment. It is rather to be a talk about academic freedom more generally. Now, happily, these are not unrelated subjects. To the contrary, the longer I have puzzled over the meaning of free expression, and the longer I have thought about education, the more the two seem to me to converge. Indeed, neither is really worth all that much without the other. First, I'll trace briefly for you the history of academic freedom, for it's only by understanding where we have been that we can appreciate, in both senses of that word, where we are today. Second, I'll offer some thoughts about what all of this means for you and for us, and about the responsibilities that we today bear in common. So it's important to understand that, like the freedom of speech, academic freedom is not a law of nature. It does not exist of its own force. It is always vulnerable and should never be taken for granted. Indeed, until well into the 19th century, real freedom of thought was neither practiced nor professed in American colleges. To the contrary, any real freedom of inquiry or expression in American colleges in this era was smothered by the dominance of religion and by the prevailing theory of doctrinal moralism, which assumed that the worth of an idea must be judged and determined by what the institution's leaders declared the moral value of an idea to be. Thus, through the first half of the 19th century, American colleges squelched any notion of free and open discussion or intellectual curiosity. Any student or faculty member who dared argue, for example, that women were equal to men, that blacks were equal to whites, or that homosexuality was not immoral, would surely be expelled or fired without hesitation. Similarly, through the first half of the 19th century, as the nation moved towards civil war, any professor or student in the North who openly defended slavery, or any professor or student in the South who openly challenged slavery, could readily be dismissed, disciplined, or expelled. When a professor at the University of North Carolina, for example, expressed sympathy for the 1856 Republican presidential candidate, the students burned him in effigy and he was dismissed by the Board of Trustees. When a professor at Franklin College in Pennsylvania admitted that he was not an abolitionist, he was promptly fired. Several decades later, a furious battle arose in higher education over Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, with traditionalists charging not only that Darwin was wrong, but also that his beliefs were dangerous, immoral, and ungodly. As a consequence of this conflict over evolution in the academy, new academic goals came to be embraced. For the first time, to criticize as well as to preserve traditional moral values and understandings became an accepted function of higher education. And by 1892, William Rainey Harper, the first president of the University of Chicago, could boldly assert, quote, "When for any reason the administration of a university attempts to dislodge a professor or punish a student because of his political or religious sentiments, at that moment the institution has ceased to be a university." But despite such noble sentiments, the battle for academic freedom has been a continuing and fiercely contentious one. In the closing years of the 19th century, for example, businessmen who had accumulated vast industrial wealth began to support colleges and universities on an unprecedented scale. But that support was not without strings. And during this era, professors who offended wealthy donors by criticizing their business practices were dismissed from such leading institutions as Cornell and Stanford. Then, during World War I, patriotic zealots persecuted and, as we've seen, even prosecuted those who questioned the wisdom or the morality of the war. In the face of such outrage, universities collapsed almost completely in the defense of academic freedom. Students and professors were systematically expelled and fired at colleges and universities across the nation, merely for encouraging a spirit of indifference toward the war. Similar issues arose again with a vengeance during the Cold War in the age of Joseph McCarthy. In the late 1940s and the 1950s, most colleges and universities excluded those even suspected of having communist sympathies from university life. Yale president Charles Seymour went so far as to boast that there will be no witch hunts at Yale because there will be no witches. We will neither admit nor hire anyone with communist sympathies. As this history demonstrates, the freedom to question, the freedom to challenge, the freedom to inquire are not to be taken for granted. Academic freedom is, in fact, a hard-bought acquisition in an endless struggle to preserve the right of each individual, student and faculty alike, to seek wisdom, knowledge, and truth, free of the censor's sword. But what does all of this have to do with you? Well, in a radio address to America in 1931, the Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw startled his audience with the following proposition. Every person who owes his life to civilized society and who has enjoyed its very costly protections and advantages, he declared, should appear at reasonable intervals before a properly qualified jury to justify his existence, which should be summarily but painlessly terminated if he fails to do so. Now, I do not advocate such a program, but I do suggest that every one of us who enjoys the protections and advantages of our hard-bought system of academic freedom has a responsibility to justify her existence under it. There are several ways in which we can meet this responsibility. First, we must defend academic freedom when it comes under attack. Like every liberty that is precious to us, the preservation of academic freedom demands vigilance, determination, and sometimes courage. Second, we must struggle to define the meaning of academic freedom in our time. As we saw in Abrams, the Constitution's guarantee of freedom of speech is not self-defining, nor is academic freedom. Each generation must give life to this concept in the face of the distinctive threats and conflicts that arise over time. Today, the principal challenge to academic freedom comes not from outside the academy, but from within it, primarily from students themselves, some of whom demand censorship of ideas that they find distasteful or offensive, and from faculty members and university administrators who, afraid to disappoint their students, too often surrender academic freedom to charges of offense. To give just a few examples, several colleges and universities, including Johns Hopkins, Brown, and Williams, have recently withdrawn speaker invitations because of student objections to the views of the invited speakers. Northwestern University recently subjected a professor to a sustained sexual harassment investigation for publishing an essay in the Chronicle of Higher Education that criticized Northwestern's sexual harassment investigations. Colorado College suspended a student for making a joke that made fun of feminism. The State University of New York denied promotion to a professor who criticized the university's affirmative action program. William & Mary and the University of Colorado disciplined students for criticizing their affirmative action programs. Students at Vanderbilt demanded that a tenured professor be fired for writing an op-ed in which she raised questions about Islam and violence. The University of Kansas disciplined a professor for mocking the National Rifle Association. Louisiana State University fired a professor because some of her women students complained that they'd been made to feel uncomfortable by her use of profanity in class. DePaul University shouted down a speaker whose views they opposed, causing the event to be canceled. At Wesleyan University, after the school newspaper published a student op-ed criticizing the Black Lives Matter movement, students demanded that the university defund the school paper. At Amherst, students demanded that the administration remove posters put up by other students stating that all lives matter. At Emory, students demanded that other students who had chalked Trump in 2016 on the university sidewalk should be punished because, in their words, a university is supposed to be a safe place for students, and this made us feel unsafe. Little did they know. And at Harvard, a professor was taken to the woodshed for offending African-American students by saying in class that he would be lynched if he gave a closed book exam. Now, to put all this in perspective, a recent survey revealed that 72% of current college students support disciplinary action against any student or faculty member who expresses views deemed by them to be racist, sexist, homophobic, or otherwise offensive. So where did all this come from? It was not too long ago when students were demanding the right to free speech. Now, at least some students demand the right to be free from speech that they find to be offensive, upsetting, or emotionally disturbing. What explains this profound shift in attitude? Well, one often expressed theory is that at least some members of this generation of students have been raised by so-called helicopter parents who protected and celebrated them in every way, shielding them at every turn from the risks of failure, frustration, and defeat. On this theory, these students, unlike their predecessors, have never learned how to deal effectively with challenge, with uncertainty, with insult, or with fear. They therefore demand the right to be protected from speech that they find to be offensive or hurtful or demeaning. If this is so, then the proper role of an institution of higher learning is not to shield those students from distressing and offensive ideas, but to prepare them for the challenges of the real world. The goal of a university should not be to insulate students from discomfort or insecurity, but to enable them to be strong and effective citizens of the world, a world that will not shield them from such expression. Now, another possible explanation of the current situation is that this generation of students is more attuned than their predecessors were to the injustices of society, to the harmful impact of hateful expression, and to the inequalities that poison our nation. To the extent this is so, it might be in part a response to the creation of social media. When I was the age of students today, we were rarely exposed to hateful expression. The mass media never carried such speech, and although we knew it existed and might have confronted it in a locker room or over dinner sometimes, we rarely, in fact, confronted it. The world of social media has changed that. Today, it is difficult not to encounter such hateful expression. On this view of the matter, students today are not timid, but bold. They seek not shelter, but justice. They understand the ugliness of such expression, and they want to protect both themselves and their colleagues and classmates from the vitriol that now poisons some forms of speech. Still another possible explanation of the current phenomenon is that some students, particularly those who come from disadvantaged, marginalized, and discriminated against backgrounds, have always felt unwelcome and unvalued on college campuses. But in the past, they remained silent because they thought it inappropriate to speak up. On this view of the matter, this generation of college students, particularly those who themselves feel unwelcome and alienated, deserve credit because instead of remaining silent in the face of oppression, they have the courage to demand equality and respect. Now, my own view, for what it's worth, is that there is an element of truth in all of these perspectives. The question is what to do about it. Now, faced with the ongoing challenge to academic freedom at American universities, in 2014, University of Chicago President Robert Zimmer charged a faculty committee with the task of drafting a formal statement for the University of Chicago on freedom of expression. The committee consisted of 7 distinguished faculty members from across the institution, and after broad consultation with faculty, students, and people inside and outside the school, we produced a brief 3-page report. So interestingly, when we wrote this report, we were thinking only about the University of Chicago. To our surprise, then, the report has had a national and even international impact. And such diverse institutions as Princeton, Columbia, the University of Minnesota, the University of Missouri, Purdue, Johns Hopkins, American University, and the University of Wisconsin, to name just a few, have now adopted that report as their own. Why should a university take the position that faculty and students should be free to advance any and all ideas, however offensive, obnoxious, and wrongheaded they may be? First, one thing we have learned from bitter experience is that even the ideas that we hold to be most certain might, in fact, turn out to be wrong. As confident as we might be in our own wisdom, experience teaches that certainty is different from truth. If those who believed with absolute certainty that the earth was the center of the universe were wrong, if those who believed with absolute certainty in creationism were wrong, If those who believed that slavery was natural, right, and proper were wrong, if those who believed that a woman's place is in the home were wrong, then why should we have the arrogance to think that we are unquestionably right about our own beliefs today? The only wise approach, as Justice Holmes made clear, is to acknowledge the risk that our certainties might be wrong as well, and that they too must always be open to challenge and to question.
You're listening to Jeffrey Stone on the Fight for Free Speech on Campus. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Experience teaches that the suppression of speech breeds the suppression of speech. If today I am permitted to silence those whose views I find distasteful, I have then opened the door to allow others down the road to silence me. The neutral principle of no suppression of ideas protects us all. This is especially important, I should say, in the current situation. For in the long run, it is likely to be minorities, whether religious minorities, racial minorities, or political minorities, who are most likely to be silenced once censorship is deemed acceptable. Censorship is never a one-way street, and this is a door we do not want to open. Third, a central precept of free expression is the concern with chilling effect. That problem is especially acute today because of the effects of social media. It used to be the case that students and faculty members were willing to take controversial positions, in part because the risks to them of doing so were relatively modest. One could say something provocative or even outrageous in a discussion in a class or dorm, and the statement soon disappeared from view. But in a world of social media, where every comment one makes can be circulated to the world and can later be called up by prospective employers or graduate schools or neighbors or prospective dates with the mere click of a button, the potential cost of speaking boldly and courageously, of taking controversial positions, of taking risks, is greater than ever today. Indeed, according to another recent survey, 65% of all current college students say that it is unsafe for them to express unpopular views. And this has clearly had an effect on faculty as well. In this setting, it is especially important for institutions of higher learning to stand up for free expression. So how should all of this work in practice? Should students, faculty, and other speakers be allowed to express whatever views they want, however offensive they might be to others? Yes, absolutely. Should those who disagree or are offended by the views and speech of others be allowed to condemn those views and those speakers in the most vehement terms? Yes, absolutely. Should students, faculty, and community members who oppose the speaker be permitted to disrupt an event in order to prevent that individual from speaking and to prevent others from hearing that individual? Absolutely not. Although non-disruptive protests are both permitted and indeed encouraged, disruption of the rights of others to speak and to learn and to listen is wholly incompatible with the central principle of academic freedom. Should those who are offended and who disagree with the views of others be allowed to demand that the institution punish those who have offended them? Yes, absolutely. Should a university punish those whose speech annoys, offends, and insults others? Absolutely not. So what, though, should a university do? First, a university should educate its students and faculty about the importance of civility and mutual respect. As a former student wrote to me recently, a university has an obligation to create a community of people as well as a community of ideas, a place where everyone feels certain that they are unambiguously welcomed. This must be a core institutional value, but it is a value that must be reinforced and reaffirmed by education and by example, not by censorship. Second, a university should encourage free, open, and robust discussion, disagreement, argument, and debate. It should instill in its students and faculty the importance of winning the day by facts, by ideas, and by persuasion, rather than by forced disruption or censorship. Indeed, for an institution of higher education to fulfill its most fundamental mission, it must be a safe space for even the most loathsome, offensive, and disloyal arguments. As a former colleague of mine at the University of Chicago Law School, who stepped down a few weeks ago as President of the United States, observed in a recent commencement address, no matter how much you might disagree with certain speakers, don't try to shut them down. Let them talk, but have the confidence to challenge them. If the other side has a point, learn from them. If they're wrong, rebut them. Beat them on the battlefield of ideas. And you might as well start practicing now, because one thing I can guarantee you, you will have to deal with ignorance, hatred, racism, and stupidity at every stage of your life. Third, a university must recognize that our society, being flawed as it is, the costs of free speech will often fall most heavily on those groups and individuals who feel the most marginalized, unwelcome, and disrespected. All of us feel that way sometimes, but in our often unjust society, the individuals who most often bear the brunt of free speech, or at least of certain types of free speech, tend to be racial and ethnic minorities, religious minorities, women, gays, lesbians, and transsexuals, immigrants, ideological dissidents, and the like. Universities must be sensitive to this reality. Even if they cannot solve this problem with censorship, they can and should take other steps to address the special challenges faced by groups and individuals who are most often made to feel unwelcome and unvalued by others. Institutions of higher learning must take this challenge seriously. They should encourage civility and mutual respect. They should support students who feel vulnerable, marginalized, silenced, and demeaned. They should help those students learn how to speak up, how to respond effectively, how to challenge those whose attitudes, whose words, and whose beliefs offend, appall, and outrage them. This is a core responsibility of these institutions, for the world is not a safe space, and it is our job to enable our graduates to win the battles they will need to fight in the years and decades to come. That is not a challenge that universities can or should ignore. So let me now return to my central theme. What is it that makes for a great educational institution? It is, I submit, the intense, strenuous, and constant intellectual activity of the place. Presented with many points of view, students must be compelled to speak and to think for themselves. At a great educational institution, the air is electric with ideas and with questions. And it is from that environment that students derive an intellectual stimulation that should last them the rest of their lives. This is the true meaning of education. Your responsibility as a student is to test what you are taught at every turn, to challenge your teachers, your classmates, and yourselves, to choose your own values and your own beliefs. To meet this responsibility, you will have to be independent, you will have to be daring, you will have to take risks. It is not easy to tell your professor, who has devoted years, perhaps decades, to mastering her subject, that you disagree with her latest observation or theory. But the discourse of a great university should be an incitement to risk and to boldness. If you find yourself hesitating, if you feel timid, if you wonder if it's worth it, think of the rebels in Abrams. At an age not much older than you, they dared to take on the government of the United States. You certainly can take on a mere professor. The faculty of a great institution of higher learning ask nothing of you that they do not also ask of themselves. Even the most distinguished teacher and scholar routinely suffers frustration and failure. It is only by taking risks, by daring to ask questions that no one else has ever asked, that real contributions can be achieved. Thus, if your professors ask you to take risks, know that they take risks as well. At an institution like the University of Oregon, you should never forget that the only appropriate response to even the most withering question is not resentment, but gratitude. Fulfilling the responsibility of academic freedom means more than challenging your classmates and your teachers. It means also challenging yourself. It means being willing to reconsider what you yourself have come to accept as true. In 1921, after 2 years in prison, Molly Steimer, one of the Abrams rebels, was deported by the United States to the Soviet Union. It was not what she had expected. Disappointed in the political and economic system that she found there, Molly Steimer again agitated against the government. Again, she was arrested, prosecuted, and convicted of sedition. In 1923, she was deported from the Soviet Union. Now, I don't know for sure, but I rather suspect this was an unparalleled achievement. To be convicted of sedition and deported within 5 years from both the United States and the Soviet Union. Whatever else one might think of her, Molly Steimer was not afraid to reconsider her positions. In 1919, a majority of the justices of the Supreme Court in the Abrams case rejected the bold approach of Justice Holmes and opted for a safe view of the First Amendment. 50 years later, the Supreme Court unanimously overruled the majority opinion in Abrams, and embracing Justice Holmes' dissenting opinion, held that the government may not punish even speech that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death, unless that speech is both intended and likely to incite imminent lawless action. To reach this result, the court had to challenge the first principles of its predecessors and to overturn half a century of precedent. A great university, like a successful court, must dedicate itself to the rigorous, open-minded, unyielding search for truth. You will learn here to ask the hard questions, but it is not enough to examine the premises, beliefs, and assumptions of an earlier time and find them wanting. It is too easy to dismiss those who thought that the earth was the center of the universe, that its resources were boundless, that only men should vote, that marriage is for people of the opposite sex, or that separate could ever be equal. You must remember that you too hold beliefs that your children or your children's children will rightly come to regard as naive, foolish, perhaps even obscene. You must be prepared to challenge your beliefs, to reform your world, just as the rebels in Abrams struggled to reform theirs. You too must challenge the nature of things. So to return to the question with which I began, where the hell are you supposed to be going? As you've no doubt surmised, your adventure has no predetermined path, no assigned destination. Let the journey engage you, for as the humorist Will Rogers observed almost a century ago, even if you are on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there. As Justice Holmes mused in Abrams, all life is an experiment. May your life's experiment be filled with curiosity, with boldness, and with courage. Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions, only if they're nice, though. So how is it that students can promote the discussion that should go on, both among students who have similar views and, more importantly, students who have different views? So I think that an institution should create organizations that exist for the purpose of bringing together students from different organizations, which are sort of subsets of similar students, into debates with one another. I think that students themselves should create organizations that have the purpose of debating issues about which there are strong disagreements. From an institutional perspective, I would encourage, again, student opportunities to express their views, to argue their positions, to listen to one another, to protest if they want to protest, at least in ways that do not prevent others from speaking. And I think part of what's happening now, which is interesting, is that universities have not thought about these issues carefully, because they didn't come to the fore until very recently. So this question of how do you deal with students who feel unwelcome and alienated and unvalued is something we don't have good answers for, frankly. I don't think we have thought about that systematically until the last couple of years. The one group, I think, for which institutions did think about this a while ago were gays 25 years ago. Because gay students were in the closet and they wanted to be able to talk to each other, but they didn't want people to know they were gay yet. And institutions tried to figure out mechanisms that would enable them to talk to each other without having to reveal that their own sexual orientations. In this context, I think that we need to be equally creative about ways to facilitate the interests and needs and feelings of students and to give them opportunities to express their views and to listen to those views. I just don't think censorship is an acceptable response. And I go back to what I said earlier. I think encouraging opportunities for students to listen to one another, to hear ideas that surprise them, and to challenge them and to test them and to say this is wrong. And again, I do think that, as a teacher, I think a fundamental responsibility I have is getting my students to be able to be effective out there in the real world. I think the real world does not shield people from things they don't like, and we have to prepare them to deal with that, and I think that's critical. The University of Chicago has a policy called the Calvin Report, named after Professor Harry Calvin, who actually was my teacher when I was a student. Very few of any other universities have this policy. The policy was put together during the Vietnam War. And the question that it addressed was whether a university itself should take positions on issues of public policy. And it arose in the context of demands that the university should condemn the Vietnam War. Demands on the part of students, including, I might say, me at the time, not yet understanding what I later came to understand. What the Calvin Report said is that it is inappropriate for a university as an institution to take positions on matters of public policy unless those policies directly affect the functioning of the university itself. And the reason for that was really twofold. One is that to have a free and open and rigorous and courageous debate, you don't want Big Brother telling you what's right and what's wrong. That will dampen the willingness of faculty and students to take the contrary position, and that's not consistent with trying to create an environment in which people feel free to themselves to take whatever views they want. And second, it opens the door, as all suppression of speech does and all positions do in this context, putting pressure on the institution to take positions, particularly, I must say, by donors and by board of trustees, about things that they don't like and don't want. And putting the university in a vulnerable position like that is something that the Calvin Report said is not a wise idea. Once you take positions, then other people say, well, I want you to take a position on this, as long as you're taking a position on that, right? So, you know, if you can take a position on Vietnam, why can't you take a position on abortion, right, or on gay rights? On either side, depending on what the people demand. So that was the reason for the policy. But it also had this exception that when the matter directly concerns the functioning of the university, that the institution can take a position. So I'll give you an example. If Congress were considering a law that the federal government would not provide Department of Education funds for any institution that engaged in affirmative action, it would be appropriate for university, because that directly affects the university, to take on that issue. On the issue of should we be taking a position on Palestine versus Israel, the answer would be no. That's not something that directly affects the core functioning of the university. I don't think that it's appropriate for the president of a university or dean to take a position in the role of president or dean, and that gets complicated as to how you can distance yourself, but certainly not in the position of president or dean about issues that are public policy issues. Now, again, you know, deans and presidents could be scholars and they write things and they talk about issues, and that's when they do in their private capacities. But as institutional leaders, I think they should not do that. And I think in hiring faculty, it's appropriate to look for intellectual diversity. You know, a department should look seriously to create a clash of ideas among qualified people, and that it's a positive thing to have faculty coming at issues from a range of different perspectives. I think that's part of the responsibility of hiring, is to try to seek that. You know, why is it that the vast majority of academics tend to be more liberal? Well, one answer is, well, smart people are liberal because they're smart, right? They know the right answers, right? And there may be an element of truth to that. I don't know. Sounds right to me. But whatever the reason, that's not a healthy environment. Right? In a society in which there are a range of different views, you want an intellectual environment in which all those views are stated. And one of the ways to do that, by the way, is to invite speakers. Right? So to the extent you can't suddenly hire a bunch of conservatives, right, out of the blue, you can invite speakers who will present those views and pose those positions for faculty and for students. And I think that's exactly the right thing to do. And so universities have to make judgments about quality of scholarship in order to have the best possible academic achievements. Those should not be based on ideological differences. They should be based on quality, and sometimes it's hard to separate them, but that should be the aspiration and the goal. We have to grade student papers, and you can't just say, well, it's a marketplace of ideas, everything's equal, so everybody gets an A, right? It could do that, but that's not what we do. We are making judgments about things. But again, it should not be about ideology, right? One should not downgrade a student because he or she says something that you disagree with if it's well-reasoned and so on. The classroom, again, is a setting which is not a free and open debate, obviously. Both the faculty members and the students are under a set of constraints because of the particular function and purpose of a classroom. And you can't, you know, get up in the middle of a class on physics and start talking about free speech when it's not the subject of the class. So I think those are the parts of the institution that you try to maximize the free speech, and you try to be as committed as you possibly can to the values of free speech. You don't downgrade people because you disagree with them, but you still have to make judgments about quality and excellence and so on. With respect to the marketplace of ideas notion, the marketplace of ideas is imperfect for obvious reasons and all sorts of obvious reasons, but I believe it's better than any alternative, and that the goal is to try to improve the marketplace of ideas. But I trust the marketplace of ideas more than I do a president of the United States or a president of a university to decide what views are acceptable and what are not. So it's not a perfect solution versus an imperfect one. It's a matter of degree. And I think what Holmes said is, you know, the best test of truth, not it's always true, but the best test of truth is fight it out, argue it out, listen to each other, and try to come to the best possible solution rather than have some platonic guardian tell you what the truth is and then have to live with it. So truth in the context of the metaphor doesn't necessarily mean factual, yes, black and white. It means both that and it means values and understanding across the spectrum of things. Even with respect to things that are factual in the realm of science, for example, I think it's always necessary to challenge the accepted wisdom in science. Somebody may say, this is fact. This is what it is. We've done our science. You're done. You can't challenge that. Maybe it's right, but we know it may not be right. It may be that some other person will discover something that will suddenly cast that into doubt. And so I don't think that we should regard scientific truth as any more truthful than any other truth, because it can be wrong, and it's important to always be open to that. With respect to values, I think that, you know, a great example of the way the marketplace of ideas, and it's a metaphor, operates, I think, is what's happened in our society with respect to the issue of both homosexuality, sexual orientation, and same-sex marriage. If you go back only a very short period of time, right, the American people would have regarded homosexuality as sinful, as immoral, and maybe even criminal, although there were not many prosecutions, but certainly sinful and immoral and something that was perverted. And the idea of same-sex marriage would have been completely crazy and off the charts, even if you go back 30 years. And because we've talked about it and fought about it and argued about it, society's attitudes have changed dramatically. And, you know, is there a truth? I don't know what's right or wrong. You know, maybe the old view is right and the new view is wrong. But I think it's a great example of how it is that if you are able to debate and think about things and make arguments and listen to each other, that views change and people come to different conclusions. So I think that's one of many possible examples of a situation where not closing off debate affects positive change. Thank you very much.
That was Jeffrey Stone on the fight for free speech on campus. He spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Jeffrey Stone, noted First Amendment and constitutional law scholar, is distinguished professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's the award-winning author of many books, including Top Secret and Speaking Out. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Angela Davis, Laverne Cox, Arun Gupta, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Naomi Klein, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Jeffrey Stone on the fight for free speech on campus, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Mario Savio of the Free Speech Movement, speaking on the University of California's Berkeley campus in 1964.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.